This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Time now for the nationally syndicated radio show, The World of Lori Zook. And now, here she is, the smart, the sexy, the savvy, Divine Miss C.
And welcome to the show. Now, today, I'm very fortunate. I have a guest that is an author named Aaron Clary, who recently did a couple of shows with me on his inspiring book, The Curse of the High IQ. Aaron has a lot of followers on his blog, on his YouTube. And what I like about Aaron is he pretty much says it like it is. There's no pussyfooting around. It's just explain it so that people can understand it, but get to the point. And that's what I like. So, Aaron, I want to welcome you back to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Well, we're going to cover a couple of your books. You've written several books. I think I read all of them in about a day each, because once I start your book, I go, wow, this is just getting it's getting better and better. And it's one of those things where, you know, I'll stay up till 2 a.m. going, yeah, I'm reading the book and I can't put it down. So I don't like to lose my train of thought once I start something that's really good. And so you wrote a book called Worthless. Now, before we talk about Worthless, just share a little bit with our listeners about yourself.
Well, I was originally a banker and economist by training, and then wrote my first book predicting the housing bubble back in 2006, 2007, and ended up finding out that my penchant wasn't banking, but actually writing, and then with the advancement in social media, kind of becoming a micro internet celebrity. So I got a YouTube channel, and I got the books, and I have the blog, and I have a podcast. So I'm approaching my fifth year working for somebody ever. So, yeah, that's what I do now. And it is a lot better than driving in a commute and sitting in a cube.
Right. And you get to travel all over. You can pretty much work from anywhere, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, as long as I got my laptop and my microphone, that's all I really need. And so, yeah, I just got back from a 2-week motorcycle ride out east. And, yep, everything fit in my backpack.
That's awesome. Well, let's talk a little bit about Worthless first, because this is the young person's indispensable guide to choosing the right major, and it's geared towards students. Now, that is the premise of the book. Why did you write it?
Well, it was like the housing bubble. I mean, this is bar the retirement bubble, this is the biggest bubble out there, even to today, especially when I was writing it back then, and that is where we get these kids to drop about, well, back then, $500 billion, now it's up to maybe $1 trillion a year on degrees that just aren't worth it. And so it's no different than any other bubble. They're borrowing money back to invest in an asset that is never going to generate the rate of return. So I try to write this book warning young people, or even people, anyone of any age, frankly, that wants to go to college, saying, hey, there's a lot of people out there and a lot of money that wants you to go and waste it on these degrees. And so before you do that, you should do some research and a little bit of due diligence and make sure that the degree you're pursuing is worthwhile.
You know, it's interesting. When I was growing up, it was always assumed by my family and by most middle-class families, you are going to college when you get out of high school. And I think it's hard for someone, you know, in their mid-teenage years, you know, when they start talking about, well, what are you interested in and what do you want to do? Teenagers really don't, most of them, and I'm not going to say all, but most of them really don't know what they want to do with their life. And so, you know, a lot of times maybe they might do what their parents do. They might think what's fun. But you're right. When they get out, you know, you're talking about the student loan debt issues. And you know, I work as a credit consultant, and I get people all the time that have student loans. Oh, geez, I looked at one today, Aaron. And the guy must have had 10 student loans because there's one for each semester. And I'm telling you, they're all maxed out. And I don't know actually what he does for a living, but if you don't, you're not going to earn that income. This is why we have the second wave of foreclosures basically, but with student loans, correct?
Correct, yeah. And I'm even expecting, not to get all central banky on people, but just like the Federal Reserve was used to bail out all those mortgages, like they bought all these bad mortgages in the market, I'm predicting the Federal Reserve is actually going to start buying student loans, because a lot of them are guaranteed by the federal government, by the U.S. taxpayer. So, yeah, the finances just don't affect the poor kids that go and major in fluffy bunny studies. It's going to affect the U.S. taxpayer, I predict, in the future.
It's a shame, I think. Now, you know, parents being still conditioned to send their kids to college, good or bad?
Oh, bad. Very, very, very bad. No. In the 40s and 50s, even the 60s, it's basic simple economics where if a few people go, then there's those skills or those degrees are rare, and therefore they have more demand. But when you force everybody to go, then it's just the modern-day equivalent of a high school diploma. So it is not just, oh, you could go to college and any degree is a good degree and it'll get the foot in the door, yada, yada, yada. Now it's like, no, not any degree is a good degree. You have to be very discriminating with what type of degree you get. And even then, you have to spend some time figuring out what it is that you'd like to do. A lot of times, it's just not even worth going to college. A lot of times, it's worth taking some time off and going to figure out who you are, what you like to do in life, and so on.
Right.
Sure that you know you want to go ahead, and this is the career, then invest in yourself. But this mindless forcing kids to go to college when half of them don't even know what they want to study, that's very bad.
Right. And yep. And I understand that completely. Oh my gosh. Let's talk about some of those worthless degrees. I have to tell you now, I from reading your books, I don't watch TV very often. Once in a while, you know, if I'm eating lunch at home and I'm by myself and I turn the TV on for a few minutes and these commercials come on for these little like technical schools, I think of you, Aaron, and I go, oh my gosh, I just have to start laughing. Now, I don't remember what school it was. I think it was a cosmetology school my friend's daughter was going to here in the Tampa area. I want to say there were probably a number of campuses, maybe 10 or 11. I'm not sure if it was just the state of Florida or not, but they took the tuition, and then, and this is only a few weeks ago, and then the school closed up. They had no more money. And I thought, my gosh, like, you know, what do you do in a situation like that?
Well, if you're a student, you celebrate because you're not going to borrow any more money. That basically is what happened. That happened to ITT.
Yep.
Well, it's happening to a lot of these fly-by-night for-profit colleges. One I worked at, I used to teach economics over at Le Cordon Bleu. I'm sure some of you remember that company. That's gone now.
Okay.
And, I'll become cosmetology, medical, who wants an exciting career in medical transcriptioning? I'm like, nobody, because it's not an exciting career. It's not a real thing.
Right.
These for-profit colleges, they ended up, they were called Pell Grant sponges, where they just sop up all the kids' money. And now with the federal government cracking down on that, they lost a lot of their accreditation. But that's the best thing to happen to those kids because they wouldn't go into any more debt to pay for these predominantly worthless degrees. So I know a lot of these ITT grads, you know, there's always the news story. Oh, poor Jimmy Johnson, and oh, he was going to get his degree in nose-picking studies or whatever they're offering at ITT. And, you know, what am I supposed to do with my life? It's like, celebrate because you only had one semester of college debt.
Right.
But again, they're so brainwashed and conditioned to think that all there is in life is college. There's nothing else in life. If you don't go to college, you're a worthless human being unless you go to college. They don't know any better or know that there's other options out there for them.
Well, I think a lot of the parents pressure them because maybe the parents themselves, depending on how old they are, didn't have the opportunity to go. So you always heard, you know, a great education. And maybe 30 years ago, 40 years ago, more, you know, back then, maybe that was true because when you got a job, people tended to stay at their job for long periods of time. But that's changed over the years. And so companies nowadays, you know, you're in, you're out. I mean, when I worked in sales many years ago, you know, and you turned in a resume to an employer, it wasn't done like it is now. Nowadays, they scan it, right? Like they're looking for keywords on monster.com. And you're not personally, you're not seeing anything about that person other than it's on a piece of paper. So how do you even evaluate that?
Well, yeah, now the HR process is all streamlined. You have text recognition and things like that.
Yeah.
But speaking to the parents, yeah, it is a different journey. I mean, the economy changes over the 30, 40 years that today's parents who are alive today, even 50-year-olds whose kids are about to go to college, they're of that age or they're in college, they're thinking back to the 60s and 70s when they went to school, and they're like, yeah, any degree, I mean, yeah, back then it would help you out. But now, like I said before, I think I would say my generation, the Gen Xers, are the first full generation to go to college, regardless as to what the demands were in the economy. And then bar a little bit of hope that we had during the dot-com bubble, it became very apparent just how worthless our degrees were.
Well,
parents have to realize is that it's no longer what applied in 1970 does not apply today, 40, 50 years later.
Totally different times. Now, you know, I love your fluffy bunny analogy. Why don't you discuss some of the worthless degrees that you mentioned in your book and explain? I don't even think you need to explain why they're worthless, but maybe you do.
Well, okay, fluffy bunnies do not major in fluffy bunnies.
Okay.
If any school is offering a fluffy bunny degree, that's a bad. In general, what you want to avoid are the humanities and the liberal arts. And everybody gets so upset and takes personal offense. It's like, look, I'm trying to save you money, and we're talking about $100,000 in tuition. We don't have time for feelings right now, all right? If you're going to drop, they always say that you can't put a price on education. Yes, you can, because if you're putting $100,000 down, there better be a financial reality and a financial payoff for that investment. So you don't want to go into the liberal arts. You don't want to go to the humanities. This doesn't mean you can't study these things, because guess what we have? We have these things called libraries, and you can get these books for free. You could go on the internet and study it for free. You can listen to podcasts. All that data and information is out there, and you can study it till your heart's content. And guess what? Whether you have a doctorate in philosophy or you just read a lot of books in philosophy, your employment prospects are still going to be the same. You are still going to be pretty much unemployable, except the person who went to the library and read and learned a lot about philosophy didn't go into debt to pay for a doctorate in philosophy, and they're still working as a barista over at Starbucks.
Right, because there's
I'm not saying this to poke holes in people's dreams. I'm preventing people from going down the road to nightmares. So, yes, study your hearts. If you have an interest in art, go become an artist. If you have an interest in philosophy, but do not pay for it. Jimi Hendrix doesn't have a doctorate or didn't have a doctorate in guitar. He just played guitar. So that's kind of the realm of worthless degrees. There's others, you know, your ITTs, and hey, you know, are you sitting at home on the couch because it's the daytime and you're an unemployed slob?
Those commercials.
An exciting career and whatever it is, you know, that's kind of another hint that the degree in the school is worthless.
Right. I agree. And I wanted to mention earlier, now I have a friend younger, 20 years younger than me, but she had a Pell Grant, went to school, went to the county college here, got, I think, an associate's degree in diet and nutrition. She's an incredible chef. She's vegan, cooks really well. She worked for me at one point a few years back, and so I gave her a great reference. And so she got a job, I think it was like an assisted living type, you know, preparing food for the elderly, that type of thing. And you know what? It pays minimum wage. Minimum wage. Even with that degree that she didn't have to pay for because it was a grant, she's having a hard time finding a job that's actually going to pay her any money.
So this gets back to supply. Look, when I taught with Cordon Bleu, these culinary schools, they're the worst. They're not the worst, but they're up. They fight for the worst position, ranked number one as the worst. Everyone wants to be, wouldn't it be cool to become a chef? Well, if everyone's becoming a chef and there's millions of people applying to culinary school and millions of kids being dumped out into the labor market every year after graduation, there's only so many restaurants, and there's certainly only so many five-star Michelin restaurants.
Right.
And they're told and sold on these lies that you're going to be the cafeteria clerk at a nursing home. That's where the jobs are.
Exactly.
Don't be surprised when you flood the market that wages go down.
Yeah, you know, talk to me a little bit about how do schools prey upon students? You know, we obviously see the commercials, but how do you feel that they prey upon students?
Well, there's two ways. The fly-by-night schools, and the only reason I keep bringing them up is because they're very damaging, and two, I worked at them. They go after the students that were rejected by every other accredited school. And so these kids, like, you know, they're really popular in high school. High school is about to end. They didn't study. They can't even get into a community college or a junior college. So then they go to these for-profit schools that don't care about their GPA, don't care, hey, at least you got into college. And a lot of time their parents don't know any better. Oh, at least they're in college, and they don't care what. Little do they know it's not accredited, their credits can't transfer, and the degree they're about to get is, and they charge an arm and a leg. I mean, this was 10 years ago. The school that I taught at is charging $37,000 a year, and this is not accredited, this is nothing.
Wow.
And so it's certainly probably more now. The other way that universities and colleges, higher education, prey on the younger kids, is where you have accredited schools. And just because it's accredited doesn't mean it's not a scam. And this gets predominantly into the liberal arts and the humanities. You have two generations now, the baby boomers, although they're slowly moving out, baby boomer professors and Gen X professors and teachers' assistants and all that, not to mention the chancellors and deans and assistant deans, the diversity counselors and assistant reserve break glass in case of emergency cafeteria chancellors, all these other overhead they don't need. These people make their money. Or no, we're talking almost $1 trillion a year now being flooded into this market. That's more than big oil.
Okay.
And so you darn right there's going to be people coming out of the woodwork to capitalize on it. And if you look at the previous two generations of people who, quote, followed their heart and hopefully the money will follow, those who can't do teach and they end up in academia. And so the only thing they can do is reteach the worthless garbage they got of suckers. Yeah. And so that's why there's a big push for the liberal arts, the side that the bread is buttered on, but also there's a huge ego investment. I mean, really, you look at some of these professors. Take, for example, let's take a doctorate in communications, the most worthless study ever, if I've ever heard of one. If that's your pinnacle achievement, chances are you ain't got much else going on in your life. And your ego cannot withstand the fact that if it weren't for academia, if you couldn't reteach the same worthless slot that you were taught, you'd be out slinging coffee. Well, so a lot of these people, they not only have a financial vested interest, but they have an egotistical invested interest. And so they make it sound, oh, follow your heart and the money will follow. And, oh, how dare you slam on the humanities and the liberal arts. That's the racket. And it sells very well to young idealistic 17-year-olds.
Right. And, you know, you're making me think. I mean, over the years, I've known friends that went to school forever. You know, they would maybe they would get their bachelor's and then it would take them multiple years to get their MBA and then multiple more years. It's like they're a forever student. They can't seem to get disconnect from school and get themselves into the real world. But of course, the schools are profiting from that. So explain a little bit. You know, you were kind of talking about it, but explain in the book what you mean by basic economics.
Well, basic economics is you have to look at supply and demand. There's two sides, supply and demand. Okay, what does the economy demand? Well, if you want to find out what the economy demands, make a list of what you're going to buy for Christmas, make a list of what you're going to buy, gift or not, what you're going to buy, like groceries, gas, et cetera, in the next week. Take a look at your budget, say, okay, where's all my money going? And then ask, who makes that stuff? Well, looking at gas. All right, well, that's petroleum engineers and chemical engineers and chemists and things like that. I want to buy a car. Okay, that's mechanical engineers and metallurgists and tradesmen, you know, the auto workers, people like that. Oh, your electricity has gone out. Now you got to hire an electrician. I've never, ever, ever sent my mom a Christmas wish list that said creative writing degree. I've never sent my mom a Christmas wish list that said lecture in women's studies because people just don't demand it.
Right.
So there's no demand for certain things in the economy, but then there's the supply of labor of people who want to study, you know, what they want to. And they never reconcile what they'd like to study as to what is also in demand in the economy. So you have an oversupply of people who want. I mean, I have a cousin who got a master's in creative writing. I could have told him he didn't need it, but he felt it necessary to drop $60,000 on a master's in creative writing. That is the tail wagging the dog, where right. It's the labor telling the economy
right
what it's going to demand. And the economy says, guess what? We're the ones with the money, and too bad for you. So in the end, it's the real world demand in the real world economy that determines what gets paid and what gets rewarded.
Right. But I think sometimes, too, employers want to see a degree. I like to self-study. If there's a topic I'm interested in, I study it until I feel like I'm an expert on that topic. I read every single thing I could possibly find on that topic. But if I went to use whatever that category was and I wanted to apply for, you know, a job in that field, someone with a degree in that field is going to beat me out because I don't have the degree in that field. But I think that's a whole nother topic. Let's talk about, you were talking a little bit about courses and majors a student should study. So talk a little bit more about like what, you know, what should they be doing and how do they find out that information, you know, where the money is?
Well, the sweet spot is, I like to call it, as long as you're in the ballpark, because I have a lot of clients that come in. I run a consulting company on the side, and a lot of it is helping young men and women figure out what they should study in. And as long as you're in the ballpark, meaning you are starting to choose fields that are in demand by employers, you're going to be okay. Because from there, it's really up to your specific interests and what you like. So what you want is you want two things. One, a field that's in demand, and two, something that you have an interest in. And this is sometimes hard because the stuff that is in demand is usually much harder skills because there's so few people in that field, like brain surgery or heart surgery, surgeons right. in general. It takes a lot of effort. You know, engineering, that's a lot of calculus. That's a lot of math. Computer programming, that tends to be boring. But in the realm of basically not the liberal arts and not the humanities, there should be a field that pays well and is of intellectual interest to you. And it doesn't have to be a degree. It could be a trade. A lot of young men I know are becoming welders and electricians and plumbers, making way more than people yeah. even graduating with masters in the liberal arts. But as long as it's in demand and something that you have an interest in, then you're pretty much golden.
I'm going to agree with you. I mean, nowadays, young people, they don't seem to be quite as motivated to not just the debt, but take on those longer term things like becoming a heart surgeon, where you're going to have to go for years and years of specialized medical schooling. But if you're good in the end, of course, that's going to pay off. Whereas I can see if you have a trade. Listen, I have a friend who's a piano tuner. I can't even guess what he makes. He must work 6 days a week, sometimes seven. Every day he's out tuning. He's out tuning because he's a musician. But that's how he actually makes his living, is tuning pianos. And he makes a lot of money. And so the courses to train and things like that are much less expensive. And I think, you know, he probably makes $90 an hour tuning pianos.
I got a chimney sweeper. I swear, if I ever lose this job, I'm becoming a chimney sweeper because I paid this guy to come in with his gear, and for 30 minutes of work, it's $120. Now, he does a great job, but honest to gosh, that can't take more than a day or two to figure out. Hang a shop sign in front of your internet website, and off you go, yeah. you know, old Aaron's chimney cleaning. And those guys are not looking for food come wintertime.
Yeah, it makes me think of Dick Van Dyke. What was it, a Mary Poppins, when he was the chimney sweep? All you got to do, yeah, Aaron, is dance. Yeah, yeah. You got to sing and dance and do your little YouTube thing, and you probably would make a lot of money, you know? Yeah. So, you know, college, I think it can be right for some people, but it does seem like it's all about the money. What about internships, good or bad?
Generally bad. They have to be paid, because I did my fair share of internships. They have to be paid. And they have to give you experience. That is just out of simple self-respect. Most of the employers today use internships as a way to get free labor. They will lie. There's no other way to do it. They will lie about the job description. Say, oh, yeah, get some great experience. And then they don't even help that much. What was his name? Paul Destroys Everything. That show. Have you ever seen it or heard of it?
I don't know that one.
It's this guy who goes in and he takes myths or things that are assumed as completely true, and he looked into it and they found out that, one, getting an internship really doesn't help you land a job that much more, like only 1% more with internships get a job, and then, two, the vast majority of them do not result in any new work experience, let alone any more pay than you'd get working a regular entry-level position. So if you're going to do an internship and paid, make sure you're learning experience. And I would almost say that it helps more in the IT, because they tend to do a little bit more screening. Like if you do well with an internship, okay, they'll take you on as an engineer. But for business degrees or that's where you really got to look out, because there's a lot of charlatans and scams out there.
Yeah, free labor. That's what it's called. How is it? Is it different for you know, the way you've geared the book? Are things different for women?
Yeah, because I think the laws of economics and finance, no. I mean, women can major in whatever they want to major in. But I think women on a social level, maybe a familial level, and certainly in school, like K through 12 in college, they're really told that you can have it all and follow your heart and money. Well, they will really be sold on that, the Oprah thing. And so, unfortunately, a disproportionate number of women go into the liberal arts. If I remember my statistics correctly, about 70% of the worthless degrees are women. So you always see this, they tout how women are earning more degrees than boys, and all women are conquering fields and they get more doctorates. It's like, yeah, it's in fluffy bunny studies.
Right.
If you look at engineering, women sadly only account 5 engineering majors. So there's a, I wouldn't say it's conscious or malicious. I think it's kind of like a soft bigotry.
Yeah.
Where they don't want to hurt women's feelings. And they say, you can do it all, and you could go major in marketing or nonprofit study or sociology. It's like, well, yeah, but then don't complain when you're an elementary teacher and there's millions of you being graduated every year. And then Joe Maurer, who can hit a baseball over a fence, makes $30 million a year. I mean, again, the laws of economics. We got to be more forthright with women and say, look, hey, I know you maybe, you know, you want to go help the children. So does a billion other of you. But you know what a lot of people don't want to do? Learn how to program Python or C#. And if you go into that, it'll definitely close the wage gap. So that's kind of the unfortunate propaganda women face today.
A lot of good information. I want you to stay with me. What we're going to do is we're going to go to a commercial break. When we come back, I want to talk about one of your other books called The Black Man's Guide Out of Poverty. So stay with us.
Consumers, do you have bad credit? Can't purchase a house or car? Paying too much in interest on your credit cards and loans? Scammed by credit repair companies? There is hope. You can get back on track and do it the right way. Call Credit Education Consultants today at 813-500-6064. That's 813-500-6064. Or go to crediteducationconsultants.com now and get the help you need. Don't delay. Call today. Mortgage reps and realtor inquiries are also welcomed.
Central Payment, your number one credit card merchant service provider in the industry. Providing e-commerce solutions, POS systems, standalone terminals, mobile apps, and much more, call Central Payment's James Carner at 813-777-4332. Looking for the lowest rates in the industry and number one customer service? Call Central Payment's James Carner at 813-777-4332. That's James Carner, 813-777-4332.
And welcome back to the world of Lori Zook. My guest, Aaron Clary, he writes lots of fantastic books that just, you know, just hit the nail on the head. And Aaron, we've been talking about your book titled Worthless, you know, about basically college, choosing the wrong major, you know, and how you could choose the right major. A lot of it is financial. Well, when you had first sent me the book, The Black Man's Guide Out of Poverty, you know, at first I thought it was a joke. Honestly, I go, how can this guy be selling a book like it would look racist, The Black Man's Guide Out of Poverty? But when I read the book, I see that it was a serious thing. You were actually trying to help, you know, lower income black men, you know, who are in these urban communities, not be stuck there and find something worthwhile and not make all these mistakes. And I want to talk about this book. What was your motivation to write it?
Well, it was kind of interesting origins. I run through my books and, you know, all that. You could generally say they're financial advice books. And I also have my consulting company, A-Hole Consulting, will abbreviate it.
Right.
a disproportionate of my fan base, I found out, was young black men. And I'm kind of like, I'm this evil right-wing, you know, libertarian, lower the taxes, cut social spending type of thing. And so I kind of inquired with a couple of them, and I found out there's an increasing amount of black men who, frankly, are sick of what they've been told. In terms of, you know, not to get political, but predominantly coming from the left, that it's racism and it's whitey and it's keeping you down. And in short, they're sick and tired of the defeatist tone of that. Because, like, well, okay, if everything's racism, it's out of my control, then you have to subscribe to fatism. There's nothing you can personally do. Defeating and, frankly, depressing.
Right.
What I was saying about entrepreneurship, getting off your rear, working hard, and I think also the blunt, direct manner in which I talk. And then a lot of it also came from a book I wrote called Bachelor Pad Economics. And I thought, well, okay, I got all these young black men. Why don't I write a book that's specifically dedicated towards the economic life expectancy, standards of living plight that black men face, and attempt to close it? Kind of in part for my readership. Plus, I also think it's actually quite feasible. And because deep down inside at heart, I'm an economist, I'd like to see what I could do while I'm here on this planet, what economic problems that are feasible to be solved today. And I think this is one of them. So that's why I wrote the book.
Right. And it's interesting because on the cover, you do have a black man. On the right half is the black man in the suit holding a glass of wine, very classy. But the same picture, you know, struck down the middle on the left, the guy looks like a pimp holding, you know, holding a beer. And I don't know what else is in his hand, you know, and just having that ghetto, I guess, type look. So I can understand why you would write
You know, and
I actually thought you should have just called it The Poor Man's Guide Out of Poverty, because I think it would help anyone that is in an urban community, regardless of color, even though I understand why you gave it that title. I think other people should be reading this book so that they can actually learn something from it. So, you know, you talk a little bit about the black man's plight. Talk about society and the black man in history and now, and how have things changed or have they not? Have they gotten better? Have they gotten worse?
Well, going from slavery, things have certainly gotten better. Yeah, I mean, the relationship is they were slaves, you know, 200 years ago. And so obviously that is the worst state of a relationship you can have with society. And there have been obvious improvements ever since. But we really, in my opinion, haven't treated blacks as equals simply because, they're black. And it's not even necessarily discrimination. It's just, how can we treat them? What sociological experiments can we do? So what I see today is it's almost just as bad. Well, okay, yeah, they're free, but we still, especially people in academia, politicians, et cetera, they view them as their pet project. And in doing so, you don't treat them as equals. You're like, how can we help you? Da-da-da. And there's like an element of pampering and kind of condescension where it's like, you're black, therefore you're not going to be able to do what we do. So what can we do and intervene? And in doing so, you actually make them worse off. And then in addition to that, not through any kind of malicious intent, but the black community today, especially black men, that's why I focused on black men, that's the first group of people to largely have their roles usurped and replaced by government checks. You don't have fathers or husbands anymore. I mean, you certainly do. I mean, not all, but the majority of young black boys and girls are brought up under broken homes, single parenthoods, and are also financed with a government check and not a father. And so this has been absolutely devastating and destructive, and I would contend is the primary reason for the basically dead last place position in performance of blacks in terms of standards of living, life expectancy, wealth per capita, income per capita, median income, and all that. So we've done the right thing, obviously ending slavery. That's an improvement.
Right.
But just this condescending, treating them as, and a lot of times I think it's people just virtue signaling. They don't really care about helping out their fellow black man. They just want to feel good about themselves and don't really care about the unintended consequences that might happen with whatever social experimentation they want to do with them.
Yeah. I mean, I think the whole thing in a way really is sad, because even nowadays, you know, look at what's happening with the elections. The country's so divided by groups, you know, the Hispanics and Latinas, the black people. Then you have the different religious groups. Well, you know what? Everything is divisive. We're supposed to be in the United States of America. I don't judge people by the color of their skin or by their religion, exception being, of course, if you're coming here in religious pretenses to kill other people, I have a problem with that. You know, but I try to look at the person and go, you know, is this person good? Are they kind? Are they nice? Is their heart in the right place? Versus, are they evil? Are they antisocial? Are they, you know, a sociopath or psychopath? Because those people can hide that. But you have to judge people by who they are. And if you couldn't see the color of people's skin, everybody is really the same. You know, we all have the same bones, the same flesh and blood, the same organs, the same brain. So I still to this day have a problem with people who judge other people on that criteria. People that are growing up in urban areas, it doesn't seem like it gets any better. And so, you know, you're right. You have the same situation. It's just repeating itself over and over like a hamster wheel. And these people, you know, they're talking about in the book, the young black men, they can't escape. That's pretty much what you're talking about. How can black men accurately diagnose their problems? I'm sure reading your book obviously would help. How can they diagnose their problems? Do they realize that there's a problem?
Well, their problems are they're obvious, because, I mean, right in the first chapter, I kind of highlight it. And it's not like people don't know this. The, Their income per capita is lower. Their life expectancies are lower. Higher STD infection, more crime, more jail time, stuff like that. But to that is more the symptoms, not the actual problem itself. The problem itself is basically agency. Are you going to have self-ownership? Okay. If you swallow what is propagandized to the black community, that it's hopeless, you're discriminated against, and therefore not only do you have no hope in life, you have no responsibility in life either, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So you're talking about...
Yeah, if I was...
Yeah, you're talking about accountability. Hmm. Be accountable.
Right. Yeah, well, but it's not just accountable, but it's also self-ownership and okay. statism. Like, decide now. Like, are you going to let a bunch of politicians and academians who have never set foot in the ghetto, don't know a thing about you, don't know about your life or anything, are you going to let them tell you whether or not you have control over your own destiny? Are you going to let them sell you this, oh, it's this defeatism and you can't do anything and you need our help and only we can help you? Or are you going to say, no, by golly, I am a sentient, independent man or woman. I can make decisions. I'm going to own these decisions, and I'm going to own not just the responsibilities, not just the drawbacks, or when I make a bad decision, I have to pay the price, but I'm also going to own the success. I'm also going to own the progress that comes with that. And that's probably the core right there, but it's really hard because starting, you know, for in the house, there's a cycle of, you know, blame whitey, it's defeatism, or you can't do anything. That starts at the home. It's certainly reinforced in the schools, in politics. It's got to stop somewhere, and where it happens, it could maybe be my book, maybe it's listening to alternative points of view on the internet, hopefully podcasts or the internet starts infiltrating new ideas. But for any person, period, but specifically speaking to black, ask yourself, do you want to go down like that? Do you want to just be born into this world where everything is decided for you, you don't control anything, and it's this bleak, sad, defeatist, depressing world where you're basically controlled as a second underclass and are a tool for the elites? Or do you want to say, you know what? No, I don't have to get that girl pregnant before the age of 16. No, I don't have to not act white. I do want to get good grades. No, I don't have to go and getting back to our previous conversation, major in African-American studies or grievance studies. What I'm going to do is I'm going to study chemical engineering. I'm going to get good grades. I'm going to ignore what mockery and ridicule I get for, quote, acting white or acting Asian, getting straight A's. I am going to demand better for myself no matter what people tell me. And that is not only the problem, but I believe the solution. But it's really hard for a young black man, especially a kid, to have that kind of epiphany, especially when your entire environment is brainwashing and propagandizing around you.
Right. And a lot of people are followers and not necessarily self-thinking leaders, especially if you're that young, if you're in your teen years. Now, tell me about what is the reality principle?
Well, the reality principle is my own patented, I'd have to say, because I thought it was pretty simple and apparently no one else has it.
Okay.
The reality principle is, if you make decisions based in reality or close to reality as possible, they're going to be more effective. If you base decisions in lies, propaganda, or what you'd like to be, you're going to fail or your decisions are going to be less effective. So it's kind of like a target. If I say, all right, I'm going to go and major in English, even though we live in an English-speaking country, because I think I'm unique and special and somehow I'll make big money. That is basing a decision not in reality. And okay. So I'll go 78 grand in debt. I'll get my master's in English, even though I spoke English pretty well to begin with. And I won't be able to find any jobs. And I'll end up working, slinging coffee. Right. So my decision was not based in reality. I paid the cost and consequences. If I instead say, all right, I'm going to go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. I'm going to look up starting salaries. I'm going to do research on different types of jobs and different types of degrees. Now, I'm going to choose the degree that I like and is also in demand. I find out I like chemistry, I like valence electron configuration, I like the table of elements, and I go and major in chemical engineering. I have based my decision in reality, and therefore it's much more effective. I have better results. So now I start off at 60 grand a year, fresh out of college. They maybe even pay off my debt. And then I have myself a much easier, profitable, and rich lifestyle and career because of that.
Well, I'm thinking here, yeah, because what I think when you're younger, you live in the now. You're not thinking about what your parents or guidance counselors are telling you about. No kid really thinks about, and they should, because no one teaches it, but you do, the money end of it, the financial end of it, like you're trying to drive through is, you know, it's going backward. Like, we're older, so you can go back and say, kids, if you don't look at these things, you're not going to be financially successful. You're probably not going to have the kind of money. You're probably going to be seriously in debt. You're going to have a lot of financial problems as a result. And what you're trying to do kind of is cut to the chase and say, wake up, people, because it's not the way you think it is. And sometimes I think with you know, teenagers, that's hard to do. Right. Because they want to go hang out with their friends and, you know, they want to do whatever they want to do. And they're not really thinking about down the road. And that's somewhere where even I wish, you know, that people had said, hey, maybe you shouldn't major in this. You should major in something else, because no one really talks about it. It was basically just get that college degree. It doesn't matter what it's in.
Right. You know? But that's the problem is to address the reality principle, especially with the amount of political correctness, propaganda, brainwashing. Look, and I'm used to it. I don't care how many death threats I get. I don't care how many times I'm called a racist or not. I just don't care anymore. I have zero F's to give, as it were. Most people don't have that spine, or they have a career they got to worry about, and they cannot speak their mind bluntly. But when it comes to parents, a lot of, or leaders or teachers or whatever, they frankly just don't want to hurt people's feelings. Yep. And so when you have little Amy and she wants to go and become the next rap star, or you have you know, Jerome, and this is a big problem that plagues black men. Hey, I'm going to become the next NBA or NFL player. And for you to go up to her and say, look, your voice sucks, or you're too short to play professional sports. Mm-hmm. They don't have the courage to tell them that because, frankly, they're cowards. They lack the spine. Yeah. But they'll send a kid or even an adult down the wrong path simply so they're not inconvenienced or feel uncomfortable hurting people's feelings.
Right.
Because that's the path of least resistance. They don't get any feedback, or not feedback. They don't get any a backlash from that. So it's cowardice to not tell people reality, especially children. But I understand why people do, because they lack the moral fiber and character and caliber to do it today.
Yeah, it's a different world. I don't want to run out of time because there's a lot more questions I want to get to. I just want to mention some things. So, you know, you talk in your book about how black men shouldn't screw up when it comes to children, bad company, crime, divorce, debt, housing, stupid degrees, insurance and taxes, and in education. You kind of covered a lot of that in your Worthless book that we talked about earlier in this hour. Career rules with bosses. One of the things you talk about is entrepreneurship. Is that right for everybody? Who is entrepreneurship right for?
No. It's not right for everybody, but I will say this. My readership, if you're a young black man and you're on my site, you've gone through the fire and brimstone kit, and you're reading that book, you probably have a much more independent mind that is much more conducive to entrepreneurship than the average person. Of course, not everybody can be an entrepreneur, but for me personally, for independent-minded people, for people with high IQs, it is almost – at times not an option. It's sometimes your only option, mm-hmm. because you're just going to ram heads with the commoners.
Gotcha. Lee's laughing here in the background. Yep. Now, talk about women. Explain the female paradox.
What's the female paradox?
I guess it's something that was in your book. That's all right. I'll ask you some more questions. Here's something I want to talk about. One of the things I read in your book, okay, do black men screw up more by getting women pregnant, you know, by not using condoms, by making the baby mamas, and how can they stop that cycle? Because that's something you hear about all the time. You know, if you watch these court TV cases, a lot of times it's African-American women. And it's the paternity. They got to prove it to the paternity, and the father saying, no, she slept with 20 other guys. How come there doesn't seem to be any use of condoms? Is it because the women want to live off the system and have the babies and not have to work and get paid by the government? What's the problem here, and how can it be stopped?
Oh, it's multiple problems. More or less, there's no cost or consequences when you're paid an extra check for having a kid, not to mention it's ingrained in the culture. There's really no incentive. But another thing, and this kind of this transcends race. It speaks more to the dynamic between male and female. Here in the United States, women are the final arbiters whether or not a child is born. So this has different responsibilities for both sexes. Men have to say, okay, is she going to sperm jack me? Which is an increasing concern today, where a lady will say, yeah, I'm on the pill, and she's not. And all of a sudden you got a kid, and she does that because she wants a kid, and she wants you to pay for it.
Right.
So that a lot of men, black or not, have to concern that. And once again, getting to agency and responsibility and accountability, you got to know that. So any man, black or white, has, especially black men, though, because it's more common for a woman to use a child to go ahead and get a government check, you got to wrap it up. You got to think about if Vagisil comes out, you got to think about a vasectomy. Because, frankly, I don't care how many government checks you get. If you have a kid, it is game over. Your life as you thought it was going to be is done and over. Even if you don't want to, if you want to be a deadbeat, that's fine. You can be a deadbeat dad, but it's over because they will come for you.
Right.
So, men, black or not, you got to really worry about kids really throwing a monkey wrench into your plan. And that's the number one cause of poverty is kids you can't afford. That would be, so if you can address that, that right there would make a huge improvement in anybody's life.
What are the qualifications for young black men in finding the right girl?
Oh, good heavens.
Yeah.
The right girl. Well, it's so different than anybody.
Any girl, okay.
I would say, look, she's got to be pretty enough, okay? I know when we're young and stupid, we go after the hottest thing, but if you remember the hot crazy matrix, the hotter the woman is, the more psycho she is, because society lets her get away with things. And we can laugh at it because it's true.
Yeah, but it works both ways. It works both ways, let's be truthful. It does work both ways.
It does, yeah. No, we're
but we're right. talking about it in terms of men.
How, you know, where are we looking for the women? Yeah, so as long as she's good-looking enough, I think the sixes and the sevens, maybe the eights, but you're redlining it there. You want to find a girl that's good-looking enough, but then you really want a gal that is nice and supportive. That is, out of the hundreds of girls I've dated, literally the hundreds, it is nice and supportive. I like intelligence, too. I'd say that's almost a necessary thing. But, I mean, for a one-night stand, fine, pretty will do. But if you're talking marriage and you're talking girlfriend, you're talking long-term commitment, good looking enough, that's the bottom of the three. Mm-hmm. Second would be intelligent, so she's interesting. But the third, is she nice? Is it like when you see her, there's no drama, she's supporting, you like hanging out with her, there's no drama. I have no drama. That's
right,
it. Just
right.
No drama. And you find that with nice, smart girls.
Now, Lee has a question for you he's going to ask.
Yeah, I did look into the hot, crazy matrix, and if you Google it, you'll get a bunch of charts if you look at the images in Google, which you're probably aware of. Which show exactly how it charts out. And so I showed this to a friend of mine, a guy, you know, who has a girlfriend, and he was very interested in the chart, and we seemed to agree on you know, the dynamics of the juxtaposition of hot and crazy. However, when I checked him out about a half an hour later, I actually drawn the chart out for him. And it was actually a two-part chart. I'm trying to think of what the second part was. But anyway, I walked by about a half an hour later, and he was discussing the chart with his girlfriend, and it was not a pretty
good
situation. Now, he was being he was being lectured and browbeat, and there were pieces of the chart. It was ripped up and on the floor. I was like, wow, maybe this – yeah. So just, but thanks for turning me on to that.
Yeah. Well, there are always exceptions to every rule, but you know, but I do get it.
There is a chart for guys too.
Is there? I'll have to look at that.
Which is the, I think it's like the hot money matrix.
Okay.
Right?
Oh, you're talking about women who look at guys because they want to see, you know, find how much money they have, like the sugar baby, sugar daddy type situation.
Exactly.
Oh, my God. That's a whole nother topic. Yeah.
Have you seen that, Aaron?
No, but I can imagine. I can see the logic, how it would play out.
The one for guys is like, it's like the better looking you are, even if you don't have money, you're probably going to get, you know, some kind of action. If you're above a certain money level, looks make Absolutely. No difference. She will definitely, your marriage material if you're above a certain
wow.
money level. Anyway, okay, thanks for
that's scary.
Sharing.
Okay, I'm glad I'm not like any of that. Sorry, guys. But I don't fit your criteria in those, which is good.
Little guy's corner there.
Oh, my gosh. What about marriage cohabitation for the black man, family, children? Give me your summary.
The summary, same rules as anyone else. Don't cohabitate with the woman unless you're absolutely 100% sure. Don't have kids until you can afford it. Preferably have kids after you're married, and don't have more kids than you can afford. It's really simple, you know. It's the concept of income per capita. You start spitting out capita, your income per capita goes down real quick.
All right. Let me ask you about, you know, careers. You know, there may be advantages or disadvantages. You know, you got EEO, things like that, but you talk about the rules. Do all jobs and bosses suck when it's for, you know, a young black person working?
Oh, yeah. No, it does. Now, what you got to worry as a young black man or a minority in general, male, female, doesn't matter, is are you being hired for you or are you being hired for the color of your skin? Now, for people who don't care, they just want the money, they don't really care, that's fine. They're going to get their government check. There'll be an affirmative action hiring case. And that's fine to them. But if you are a truly intellectually honest person and you don't value yourself by the color of your skin, but your accomplishments and achievements in life, you want to know if you're the best. And you don't want to be hired because of your plumbing downstairs or because of whatever pigmentation happens to be in your skin. So that's the problem that black men are going to face is if you want to be excellent, you want to achieve excellence, a guy you should totally have, Lori, on your show would be Ed Lattimore, young black man.
Okay.
He's a boxer, 13-1. He's an officer in the military, and he's a physicist.
Do you know him?
Now, that guy right there, yeah, I know him. Yeah.
Oh,
but he's the perfect example of a guy who doesn't care about the color of his skin. He wants to achieve excellence, and that is one of the most important things in life. And so when it comes to jobs, yeah, you might get easier hires. You might get, like, an affirmative action leg up.
Gotcha.
But then it's a really sad situation. Like, am I the best? Did I really earn this? And so that's the drawback that black men face.
Well, I want to thank you for joining me. Your books are great. We got about 30 seconds. Give me a quick rundown of your website, how people can contact you, your books, your blog.
Well, the flagship site is CaptainCapitalismBlogspot.com. You can find all the links to all my other websites there. You can find me on YouTube. Just search Aaron Clary. All my books are on Amazon and paper, Kindle, and audiobook. If you don't have the time to sit and read, just search Aaron Clary on Amazon. And then I have a consulting company called A-Hole Consulting, but it's not spelled A-Hole Consulting. It's spelled out.
Right.
And that is actually quite ironically popular. And you can find me on Twitter and gab.ai and other places like that.
Gotcha. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me. It's been a pleasure. I'm going to have you back again because we got some more books to cover. And join me, Lori Zook, next week on The World of Lori Zook. See ya.